I do not believe that what I want to say this morning has any immediate relevance. It falls under the general category of Torah Lishma, an exploration of our tradition for the sheer pleasure of exploring and finding out what is there. I've always found, of course, that when we take a fresh look at the past, our history and literature, the ideas of our people, there is something of benefit. But sometimes it's good to step away from the headlines and from the immediate and to look at what has been and why it was as it was. And that's really what I'd like to do with you this morning. Let me begin by taking you into my classroom at the university. We were talking about the prayer book, or rather I had assigned for reading in class the traditional morning service of our people. I was saying to the youngsters that if you want to understand what a Judah Halevi believed Judaism was, read Judah Halevi. If you want to understand what Maimonides believed Judaism to be, read The Guide to the Perplexed. But if you want to understand what Jews generally, the folk, believed, then the best thing to do is to open the Siddur, the traditional prayer book. For this is not simply a book, it is the unconscious, the memory of our people. The Siddur was known by heart. Its idiom provided the stock phrases of conversation. Its ethic, its history, its hope was the ethic, the history, the hope that was always before the mind of our ancestors. My purpose was not to teach them liturgy. My course was a course in Israel as a concept of Jewish religious thought. And what I wanted to make them perceive was the particular figuration of the hope of return, the Zionist hope, the hope of a renewal of life on the land. And as we began to read together the paragraphs of the liturgy, we were surprised, first of all, by the repetitive nature of this, how often it is spoken of and spoken of again. And then we were taken by the particular formulas that were used. Retzei Adonai Eloheinu b'amcha Yisrael u'bitfilatam. Accept, O Lord, this your people Israel and their prayer. Hashev et ha'avodah lidvir v'techa. Return the temple cult to that most holy place. V'yishei Yisrael tekabel. And let the fires of Israel be received by you. One of the students remarked, it all seems so anachronistic, as if we want to return life to what it was 1902 years ago, just before the Romans under Titus sacked the city and leveled the temple and burnt down the ruins so that nothing remained. The plea seems to be a plea to rebuild the temple walls, to return their priests to their offices, to light again the sacrificial fires upon the great altars of Jerusalem. And then another question came. If this is the image which Jews have held before them from the beginning, if the rebirth of the temple, the renewal of the cult, is in fact the basic element in the Zionist hope, why hasn't there been an effort these last 5 years at least, since the June War of 1967, to rebuild on the Temple Mount the old sanctuary and to reestablish there the old conventional ritual and ceremony? Why not? Before 1967, obviously, the Temple Mount was not in Israeli hands. But since 1967, it has been. Now, one is tempted to give an answer drawn from political prudence. The Temple Mount is today the Haram. It is the enclosed by a wall which itself encloses a sacred precinct, a precinct sacred to Islam. It is not a place which is empty or simply filled with some old buildings. It's a sacred place. The old Temple Mount is now the location of the Dome of the Rock, which some of you have seen, that great eight-sided building which was built by the Umayyad Caliph Abdul Malik late in the 7th century, over a rock which they believe to have been the rock from which Muhammad rode his steed into heaven one night during a revelation. And also on that Temple Mount there is the Al-Aqsa Mosque, a mosque dedicated by that same Abd al-Malik at the place where the first caliph of the faithful, Omar, the first caliph to enter Jerusalem, first prayed in the year 638. It's Muslim territory. And the Jews recall, for we have an historical conscience, that many centuries ago when these two buildings were in existence, in the year 1099, when Godfrey of Bouillon led the Crusader armies into Jerusalem, in a fit of piety, he raised the precursors of the modern buildings, and he built on their sites two temples to Christ. Over the Dome of the Rock, he built the Templum Domini, the Church of Our Lord, and at the site of the Al-Aqsa Mosque, he raised the Templum Solomonis, a temple dedicated to Solomon. And there, for 100 years, the Crusaders offered their devotions to God. Now, until Godfrey of Bouillon had raised the Temple Mount, most of the sheikdoms of the Near East had looked upon the attack by Europeans as another in the long, age-long series of attacks between commercial powers. Here was another evidence that the Byzantine Empire in Constantinople and the trading cities of the Po Valley and the Tiber Valley of Italy and some of the Rhineland cities were attempting to gain, to wrest economic advantage from the very fat Fatimid Empire of Egypt. They had looked upon this as another in a long series of commercial wars, and there had been no united opposition to it. But when they recognized that this was a crusade, a holy war, that the attackers wanted not only markets and the raw material of the Holy Land, but that they wanted to establish their own version of a holy kingdom, then in return to the crusade, you had a jihad, a responsive reaction of holy war, uniting of all of the Muslim world in order to push the Christian world out. And of course, the last thing that modern Israel wants to do is to exacerbate the tensions which already exist in the area. Now, that's the kind of argument that one gives if one does not understand the inner nature of our Jewish tradition. If our tradition was not what it was, I am sure that any number of government leaders would have had to insist that on the basis of political prudence, there ought not to be reestablished a temple on the old Temple Mount. Leave sleeping dogs lie. But as a matter of fact, they had to make no such speech, no such demands of restraint upon the true believers among our people. Because there was no attempt made by the Orthodox, the traditional Jewish community, to rush up to the Temple Mount and to begin to build there the old sanctuary. And the interesting question is, why not? Well, the place to begin, I suspect, is from the one small attempt made in those early June days of 67 to come to draw near, to sidle up to the Temple Mount. There was a man named Shlomo Goren. Shlomo Goren was the chaplain in chief of the Israeli army. Shlomo Goren had a very big ego, and Shlomo Goren was very much caught up with the chauvinism, the nationalism, the victory. And several weeks after the war, he took a number of his faithful, enough for a minyan, and he actually went across the threshold of the Haran, and he went to the one side, way off from the two main shrines. And there they offered the morning service. And of course, the Muslim authorities were angry, and the government reprimanded him. But most important, the rabbinate, the traditional religious leadership of Israel, reproved him, criticized him openly and bitterly. Why? Not because it is prohibited to an Orthodox Jew to enter a mosque. It is not. Over the long centuries, whenever they were allowed to enter a mosque, the Jews were free by rabbinic enactment to do so. Islam is a Unitarian faith. There are no icons, there are no idols, there are no images in the mosque. The Jew does not perform any act which is against our faith by entering in there and participating in the lectures or whatever other public occasions take place in a mosque. The Jew was not prohibited from entering the Temple Mount because there was a mosque on the mount, because this was holy Muslim territory. Over the long centuries, no Jew, however, had ever entered the Haran, in part from a large part of that time because the Muslims forbade it, but largely because his own tradition made it impossible for him to do so. How so? In biblical times, when the temple still stood, a Jew could approach the temple, enter the Temple Mount only if he was in a state of what was called tahara, ritual purity. Now, ritual purity is not cleanliness. It doesn't mean that we're wearing well-tailored clothes, that our hands and our feet and our face are clean. It means that we are declared to be ceremonially clean according to a technical definition established in the priestly legislation of our scripture. A man may be rendered unclean by many things. If we happen to be in a house in which there is a dead body, we are unclean simply by proximity to the corpse. If we eat food from which the Levitical tithes have not been taken, though that food may be otherwise ritually clean, kosher, we become tuma, unclean. We are not allowed to approach in that state the Temple Mount. And there developed over the long pre-Christian centuries a number of very technical ways to purify yourself once these inevitable moments of uncleanliness occurred. Certain kinds of lustrations and bathings were required. For certain kinds of uncleanliness, you had to touch to your forehead the dust which was taken from a holocaust made of a heifer, all of whose hair were red, the so-called paga aduma, the red heifer. Now, we have lost, all Jews have lost, the technical capacity to become ritually clean in a sufficient way to approach the Temple Mount. And so, since the second century, no rabbinic Jew, no observant Jew, has crossed the threshold of what was first a Byzantine church, and then was the Haran, and then was again a church, and then was again a sacred place of Islam, because his own tradition prohibited. Now, why didn't the rabbis in the year 70 void this old law about ritual purity? What was there about the ruins on the Temple Mount which should have made it necessary for them to maintain in their biblical form all of these restraints? Right after the destruction of the temple, they voided many old laws. Laws having to do with agricultural tithing, laws having to do with certain of the mechanisms of the calendar. Many things were set aside, set in abeyance, but not this one particular temple-related institution. And the answer, I believe, lies in three significant factors. The first is that they didn't want people stealthily and furtively to creep up to the destroyed temple area to try and offer some kind of spontaneous, impromptu sacrifice there. To have relit those lights would be an act of rebellion against Rome. And the Jews learnt in 66-70, and they learned again in 115-117, and they learned again in 133-135, bitterly, at the cost of millions of lives, the danger of continuing a futile rebellion against this vast world power. There was a good historical reason to continue this prohibition, to keep the young chauvinist, the young eager zealot, from trying to force a rebellion, playing upon the credulities and the beliefs of the people. But the second and third reason, I think, are more basic and more important. The second reason has to do, paradoxically, with the fact that even biblical Judaism was not a sacrificial faith. Yes, there were sacrifices in the temple, and yes, the temple was the place where certain kinds of sacrificial rites alone could take place. But when something is precluded to you, prohibited to you, the act which took place there becomes all important. And if Jews had lived for the day when the sacrifice had become all that important, the sacrifices would have loomed larger and larger in their religious thinking until all else which had taken place in the temple, the balance, that which was significant truly beyond the sacrifices, was forgotten. One had to approach the temple not only in a state of ritual purity, but in a state of ethical purity. Who shall ascend into the mountain of the Lord? Who shall stand in his holy place? He that has clean hands and a pure heart, who has not taken my name in vain and has not sworn deceitfully. The temple was a place not only of sacrifice, but of teaching. Here was kept the pristine Torah, the Torah as it was given by God, the Sefer HaZarah it's called. Here the priests read out and taught to the people the lessons of the Torah. The temple was so much more than a place of sacrifice. And if the sacrifice had become all important in the minds of a people longing for the rekindling of the altar, then there was danger that the vastness, the greatness, the moderation of Judaism would have been reduced to a single concern with a ritual act. And that obviously the rabbis didn't want. And the third element, which has to do with this prohibition, this continuing of the laws of ritual purity, even though they were impossible to maintain, has to do with the messianic dream itself. Long before the Roman destruction of the temple had been destroyed by the Babylonians in the year 586 before the Common Era. And 50 years later, Cyrus of Persia had allowed the Judeans to return and to rebuild the sanctuary. And they had rebuilt the sanctuary and rekindled the lights, and they had discovered that they had rebuilt a sanctuary and rekindled the lights, that the Messianic age had not come, that peace, justice, freedom, all the hopes that we pour into this word Messianic hope, salvation, deliverance, these things had not happened. And our dream, our hope, centers on a symbol. But it's so very much broader, larger, more inclusive than the mere symbol itself. That's why our faith is not at all unhappy to be able to approach the Temple Mount as far as the Western Wall, the so-called Wailing Wall, the Kotel HaMaravi. It's a ruin. It's a wall. We were excited to be back there because it meant we had approached the goal. The state of Israel was a miracle. Freedom was a miracle. Here a people which had suffered the Holocaust had somehow reestablished independence, dignity. But still, we hadn't ascended to the mountain of the Lord. We still prayed for deliverance, for salvation. Israel was, but Israel was not yet secure. And when Israel shall be secure, she must give justice, pure justice, to her people. And there must be justice and peace and security in the world before there can be security for one small nation of the world. And so there has never been a drive, a practical drive, by our people to reestablish the temple. There will not be. When Goren was taken to task for having snuck into the Haran and to have had this little minion service, his answer was interesting. He said, I didn't want to reestablish the temple cult. I know all the rules of halacha which prohibit me from entering the Temple Mount. I, in fact, hadn't gone there in the first place. I'm an archaeologist, and I'd done some surveying, and I discovered that the Temple Mount covered all the area on the top of this Judean hill, except for the little passageway that we walked down and the little corner where we stood and offered our prayers. I wanted to come as close to the Messianic promise as I could. I know the Jews shouldn't overstep their bounds. When Rabbi Nissim, the Chacham, the chief rabbi of the Sephardic synagogue, reprimanded Goren, he concluded by saying, we have the Wailing Wall, We have Jerusalem. We have come as close to the Messianic age as men can achieve. The rest, what God can achieve, is up to God. That's why our teachers have always taught that the rebuilding of the third temple will be God's work and God's work alone. Now, as I answered this youngster in class and thought about the temple and what the temple had meant in those ancient days and some of the implications still for today, I bethought myself of many things. How much we have changed. All Jews, when they prayed in ancient times, prayed facing Jerusalem, whether they prayed individually or in their congregations. When they prayed to have Jerusalem restored and rebuilt. Each year, before Jerusalem was destroyed, they gave a half shekel of their earnings, and this money was sent to Jerusalem. And it was sent from each individual throughout the Jewish nation. And it was sent for the upkeep of the shrine. And there is no indication in our past that that money had to be extorted by fund drives and UJA campaigns and dinners and honors of notables. It was given willingly and eagerly by the people, because they felt that what happened in that shrine was significant to them. Somehow, the very existence of the appropriate rite, the rite that God had commanded in the Torah, this made all things right. There was communion with, contact with the divine. And I thought of the book from which we chanted and from which I read this morning, the book of Leviticus. It's the most unread book in the Bible, and in many ways it deserves to be. It's a manual for priests. The rabbis called it the Torat Kohanim, the law of the priest class. It's a table of operations for how to organize the cult, what sacrifices are to be offered when, precisely how the sacrifices are to be offered, what the priest is to wear when he offers a certain kind of sacrifice, which part of the temple he is to enter, how he is to enter it, what is to be brought, at what hour it is to be brought, all the infinite details. A manual of operation for this great ancient shrine. It doesn't make for very exciting reading. And yet there it is in our Torah, occupying most of the third book of our Torah, the book of Leviticus, dealing with the Levites, dealing with these priestly matters. 1/5 of each year, as the book of Leviticus is read in the synagogue, these details are read out and rehearsed. Why? And then I asked myself another question. There was a strange practice in the cheder. When a 5-year-old was brought to school for the first time, he was told to recite the Aleph, the Beit, the ABCs. He was given a cookie, which was shaped like an Aleph. He should be a good student. We Jews have always approached life through the stomach. And then he was set his first reading lesson. And of course it was from the Bible. But it wasn't from Genesis 1:1. He didn't begin at the beginning. Nor did he begin in the historical portions of Joshua, Judges, Samuel, Kings, with their wars and battles and daring do, all the things that youngsters love. The first chapter that he read and the first book that he studied was the book of Leviticus. He began by reading the paragraph which I read to you this morning. God commanded Moses to command the priests concerning the burnt offerings. This is the way it shall be offered. And I've often wondered why. And I decided many, many years ago that any custom of Israel that somehow lasts over the centuries must have some kind of functional value. And if you can't find it, look for it. So I went and I looked. And I found that nobody has the answer. Some authority I went to said it was because in the old temple, the priests were the original teachers and they wanted to teach about priestly law. But we have no historical indication that's more than a conjecture. One of the rabbis had a nice little midrash. He said that the laws which had to do with holiness, this degree of sanctity in the temple, must be complemented, must be carried out by people who are themselves holy. And who is holier than the little child, the innocent, the sweet child? Before we're polluted by life, let's read from the holiest part of the law. Perhaps one knowing something about modern pedagogy would say that our ancestors knew that a child's mind responds to the concrete. He can't deal in ideas, in the abstract, but he loves to draw, he loves to detail. And I wonder how many school teachers, long before all our modern systems of education, set the youngsters to work on papier-mâché or clay, building up a temple and having a lot of priests doing a lot of things around a sacrifice, with all the animals being led in and the people coming in procession. It must have been a great first grade lesson. But that doesn't explain it, does it? The answer, I believe, lies in this, that over the centuries, our fathers wanted us to understand that Judaism is more than a do-good religion. That Judaism is more than an ethic, more than thou shalt not murder, thou shalt not steal, thou shalt not commit adultery. Judaism deals also with the relationships between man and God. Our confusions about being born, our uncertainty about what our place is in the world. Why are we here? What are we to do here? What are the relationships which must be established? How do I manage to survive the confusions, the anxieties, the fears, the terrors of every day? What do I do to prepare myself for the unknown, the grave? These questions, the questions of relationship between man and God, are at the core of a religion. That's what religion is all about. Religion is more than a set of ethics. It has to do with the movement of God among the people. It has to do with holiness. The law of Exodus is not, thou shalt be good because the Lord thy God is good. And it's not, thou shalt be just because the Lord thy God is just. But it is, thou shalt be holy because the Lord thy God is holy. And holiness means consecrated. Holiness is that sense, that very private sense that comes to us when we suddenly understand who we are, and why we're here, and where we're going, and what is demanded of us, and by whom. Here the child was told that yes, what happens in the holy place makes a difference. That the moment that of religion is the moment of communion with the power beyond, the moment of meeting God. What was a sacrifice? The man, the family, brought something which they had achieved through their own labor. The wheat from their field, a kid from their flock, the first fruits of their vineyard. And they brought these as an offering to God. From God's own to him, this was returned. And it was offered upon the altar. And the smoke from the altar went up, symbolizing in a very material way, but in a very visually effective way, the relationship between man and God. And because a sacrifice was offered in the appropriate way, precisely, by a group of men who were deemed to be holy, who operated in a holy place according to the holy word, they felt that their offering tied them to God. God was drawn down to this place, and they felt relieved of guilt, of anxiety, of fear. They were encouraged by having touched, come close to, been near to the divine spirit. That's what happened in the temple. The presence of God is everywhere, but it was somehow uniquely there. And there, having come to that holy place in the appropriate spirit, they were able to touch that reserve of energy, to draw some of it to themselves, and to use that encouragement, that new strength, to lighten the burden of their lives, to lighten their step, and to lighten their eye. There are men and women who say to me constantly, Rabbi, I'm a good Jew. I pay my taxes, I give to the appropriate charities, I'm good to my family. Why do I need to come to temple? I'm good. That's what Judaism is all about. Well, I'm delighted if they are in fact good. I've discovered also there's good and there's better and there's best. But I'm delighted if in whatever terms they think they are good, they are good. But beyond that, being a member of this religious community, or of any religious community for that matter of fact, is not simply to be a good person, to do the routine things with routine dignity. To be a religious person is to be in touch with the universal spirit, is to draw strength from a God who wills certain kinds of acts upon us, a God who loves and who wants us to love him and all men in return, a God who created out of his mercy and who wants us to be merciful and to be creative in all of our relationships. To be a religious person is somehow to be in touch with this divine spirit. And Israel touched that spirit in that great sanctuary with all this grand and eloquent pomp and circumstance which they believed to have been ordained by God. And no one today wants to, no one today will, recreate the ancient temple. Sacrifices no longer fit our aesthetic. We no longer believe that these laws, Leviticus, were actually the specific laws given immutably by God for all times. But somehow as I reread Leviticus, and I'm delighted that I'm forced to do so year in and year out by the calendar of our people, I'm reminded that a synagogue, a place of God, must be more than a school. It must be more than a place where we can debate and argue and puzzle over the immediate political problems of the day. That somehow it must also be a place of sacred worship, where one can come and touch the beauty of holiness and leave sanctified by that touch. But there must be grace here. There must be a sense here of mystery, of miracle, of the abundance of the divine energy, of the power which wills us to reach into our bundle of talents and to make more of them than we had till now. This must be a place where we can bring our confusion and find the healing silence, where we can bring our fears and find some release from our fears, where we can bring our hopes and find some confirmation for them. And a faith which does not offer to its people this holiness, this opportunity to touch the divine, fails in its primary mission. Fails to be the agent of holiness, which the book of Leviticus, the Bible's second beginning, commands us to be. Holy shalt thou be, for I, the Lord your God, am holy.